Just recording a quick intro before we get into today's podcast. There was late breaking news that came after I recorded this podcast about Lars Jorgensen, former head coach of Kentucky, which makes the following podcast more topical than ever. And I just want to sort of set the table for everybody. This is not going to be the easiest podcast to listen to. You might find a lot of stuff on here that gets you really going in one way or another, but I think it's an important conversation to have. I don't always aim for entertainment with this podcast, but I do entertain to talk about stuff that I think needs to be talked about. So keep that in mind. I won't spoil what the podcast's about. You'll find that out in a second. The second thing is I want to shout out the supporter of the Swim Brief, known as Pro Swim Workouts. Pro Swim Workouts is an outfit that has supported this podcast throughout, and it's basically a website where you can find inspiration for writing your next workout. They have thousands of workouts on there for all kinds of levels, search tools to search through them, and I know for a person like me who, you know, sometimes get a little bit of writer block when I sit down to write out a workout. I think it's a very valuable tool. And more so than that, you know, they've been great about supporting this podcast. So if you enjoy this podcast, give Pro Swim Workouts a look and see if it's something for you. And you can get a discount on a membership, a premium subscription with them, by using the code CDSwimCoach. And by doing so, you provide even more support to this podcast. So it's a win-win all around. Appreciate that. Have time and enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Swim Brief. I am Chris DeSantis. And if you listen to this podcast frequently, you know that I'm always talking about topics that come up in my coaching or people I'm working with coaching-wise. And occasionally, I bring on people here who are not swim coaches, but who I think have a really valuable perspective to bring to the world of swim coaches. And I get a lot of parents that listen to this podcast as well, so I think this is doubly important for them. Somebody I've known a long time, attorney John Little with Saeed and Little. John, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe actually this is the first time we've done this, because we have known each other for quite a while.
More than a decade, for sure.
Yeah. So let's catch the audience up on why we're familiar with each other. And we'll do it starting with, I think, you know, you've got a certain line of work. You've got a certain area that you're focused in now. Tell people who are listening what kind of work you do, typically, what kind of cases you're taking on, and then maybe even before that, back up and tell people how you got involved with cases like that.
Sure. So sadly, my practice is mostly largely devoted, maybe even entirely devoted to athletes who are sexually abused by their coaches. And specifically, most of my cases are swimming cases. Not like 15 years ago when 100% were swimming cases, but over half typically are swimming cases. And the way I got into this was I ran track at Indiana University, and Susan Wessner, who maybe your listeners are familiar, was my roommate's girlfriend, and Megan Ryther, who was a board member at USIC, which is USA Swimming's, it's closed now, captive insurance.
The insurance, yeah.
In Barbados, correct. She was on the board of that, and then she was on the board of swimming, and then she was on the board of Safe Sport, and then Brooke Taflinger was my girlfriend in college. And so I saw, you know, the swimmers were the only people who were up earlier than us.
Because you were a track athlete.
Right, we were track and cross country, and we would actually, I can remember seeing the swimmers finishing practice when I was going to practice in the mornings. And so, you know, I had a great respect for swimming and the efforts. You know, Susan was obviously a very, I think she was second at NCAAs behind Natalie Coughlin. And yeah. Brooke worked real hard. She was a Big Ten record holder in the 400 IM She was Big Ten champion a couple times, All-American, all that stuff. And I saw how hard these my friends were working and my girlfriend was working and everything. And I went on in law school. I ran in the 2008 Olympic trials. And in 2008, out of the blue, Brooke called me and said, "Hey, my high school swim coach, a guy that I knew named Brian Hinson, had been taking advantage of me and some other girls, and somebody sold, or he sold his computer online to a guy in North Carolina, and apparently there's naked pictures of me as a kid on this computer." And that, to my knowledge, is the first USA Swimming. I ended up getting laid off from the prosecutor's office in Flagstaff, Arizona, either the same day or the day after Brooke called me. And I ended up moving back to Indianapolis, living in my parents' basement, doing what I believe to be the first USA Swimming sex abuse case that ever got litigated past the initial stages. And which is why, how the 2020 piece came to be and, you know, the rest of the stuff we know. So, and it's been an involving...
Right, if you want to, just to clear up, I want to, you know, not everybody that's listening is probably as aware of all the history of this, so... Just want to tell people where to go, but this is kind of the genesis of how we got to know each other, because, you know, you're getting involved in these cases, and I was somebody who was observing. I think even before the 2020 case, I had a sense that something wasn't right at USA Swimming, that something was like, I have a, I would say, just a natural skepticism of authority. So, like, you know, when everybody else is listening, and I knew a lot of people who were like, "Wow, Chuck Wilgus is this amazing leader who's doing amazing things for USA Swimming." I heard him talk, and I was like, this guy, really? And then he does an interview with 2020, which was a night news program at the time. I have to feel like I have to explain a few things to the youngins, right? The stuff.
Yeah. It was on TV.
You turned it on, and you had to tune in at the right time, and you had to watch your news, right? But he was getting interviewed, and he had gone to a was it an ASCA convention, an American Swim Coaches convention?
In 2005 or 6, and he said, "I get a call about this." I can't remember if he said every week or every month, and they got that audio somehow.
Right, they got that audio, and they played it for him, and they're like, "So you're out there in public saying the sport has a problem with sexual abuse and telling coaches to clean up their act. Like, what have you done about it?" And he was... totally unprepared to answer that question, right?
You think I owe them an apology?
Right. So
go back and watch that, everybody. It's probably on
YouTube. I know, really, really. It is like, it just made me so angry at the time watching it. I thought, and I watched a lot of people in the swimming world sort of leap to his defense. "Oh, this was a hatchet job." I thought, no, like, you should, we're paying this guy almost $1 million to run our organization. He should be on top of this, right? He should be on top of this. But I will say, and I don't know, like, I feel like I'm not going to get any disagreement from you on this, but the only way to start changing that culture, as far as I've been able to tell, has been lawsuits.
It has.
People like yourself.
Well, but the sad story of what I've learned is, by 1986, in United States Swimming, AIG, one of the largest insurance companies in the world, you know, located somewhere in the Horn of Africa or deep in a London skyscraper, or wherever the decisions are made, told USA Swimming in 1986, "Raping children is such an exposure for us that we can't insure you anymore." So that's what USA Swimming knew by 1986. So by 2007, when I started paying attention, or 2005, when Chuck Wilgus gives that infamous speech at the ASCA convention, it was already a well-known secret. And, you know, I look back to my own athletic career in high school. I remember my coach was always angry at a particular young lady for being late to practice. 10 years later, I'm in New York City having dinner with another girl that was on my team, and she said, "Did you know that Susie was sleeping with Coach Smith in high school before practice every day?" And I said, "Oh, shoot." That's why she was late every day to practice. It was happening right under my nose.
Yeah.
And I remember in another, when I was at the highest levels of track and field, I remember our coach used to have to go to the girls' doctor's appointments with them because we all knew that the girls were getting felt up at their doctor's appointments. And the only solution was our coach had to go sit there for their doctor's appointments.
Right. Some Larry Nassar stuff, basically.
So, and beyond that, I'm the guy that gave the Larry Nassar stuff to the Indy Star. I had that information since 2009 or 10, and I tried and tried and tried to give it to law enforcement in Indianapolis until my wife gave it to a reporter for the Star in 2016. And I think what you talked about earlier about how this was kind of in the background and everything else, Chuck Welges came from a rotten sports culture in Indianapolis. He was in Indianapolis with Canoe and Kayak. So you really have to look back at people like Dale Neuberger. I don't know if he's still around and swimming.
But oh, yeah, he's still involved at the World Aquatics level, right? Yeah.
Right. So these incompetent bureaucrats like Dale Neuberger, who fail at everything in life besides sports, where, you know, look, it's not hard to fail when you're running a tax-exempt business where you don't pay the labor, right? So, you know, these people like Dale Neuberger, they knew all about this. When he was president of USA Swimming in the late 90s, they knew who Mitch Ivey was.
Right.
There was an ESPN piece on Mitch Ivey, I think 92 or 93, right? None of this stuff was secret. The problem, I think, in sport is when you're 13, you're 18, and when you're 40, you're 18. And you have these 15-year-old boys, teenage boys, who want the attention of the teenage girls that are their peers, but those girls are dating their coaches. Why are we surprised when these boys become men and date their athletes?
Right. It's the culture they've grown up in.
It's the culture they've grown up in. And until we change that culture, you know how many women have been the coach of the United States Olympic women's swim team ever?
One.
Well, one.
Well, before people say Catherine Voigt did open water swimming, but pool swimming, it's one.
It's one. We should have in swimming, of the 8 men's and women's coaches, 6 should be women. And we need to start elevating women's coaches and doing it quickly and with massive urgency. It'll never happen, but that is something that's the first reform I would propose specifically to swimming.
And why would, just spell it out for people, you know, because I'm sure there's people listening to this. I got a lot of coaches that listen to this. I think if you listen to this podcast, chances are you largely agree with me, right? But maybe you disagree with me on the margins on some of this stuff. And I agree with you that we should be taking immediate and drastic action to sort of change the landscape with regards to gender equality in coaching. But people who just go like, well, you know, that's how we just end up with unqualified people up at the top. It'll be a disaster for our system. We can't find, like, you know, I hear from people all the time who are like, well, I have to hire and I really want to hire a woman, but I don't get any good candidates, et cetera, et cetera. What do you say to those people?
Well, there's some truth in that, and I sympathize with them, and I do see in my practice qualified white males being skipped over for less qualified fill in the blank. That's true. I see that, okay? But we also need to recognize that the situation of unqualified female coaches is created by largely white male coaches making sure that women never reach the top tier of Division I coaching or never get chances to coach at national team level competitions. And so, you know, look, with the reality of the Olympics, the people competing in the Olympics are coached by their coaches, okay? Let's be honest, the coaching of the Olympic swim team is mainly logistical support and motivational speeches, okay?
Oh, you just put a dagger in the heart of half my listeners, John.
Well, no. Because the person, the athlete...
I pretty much agree with you, but it just, like, it's hard. It's hard for coaches to hear.
It's the same way in track and field. you know, you're not calling the national team coach to discuss what you're going to do the next day in the 10K. You're calling your coach, who's been coaching you, who put you here, to discuss what you're going to do. Right.
For
sure. So we need to embrace that reality, realize that these national team coaching positions are good resume fodder, and start giving them to women quickly.
Yeah.
Like, let's just cut the crap.
Yeah. And I think, like, I think one of the things that I notice and I spend a lot of time thinking about, because we talk a lot about sport culture on this podcast, it's something that I just end up obsessing over, is we have all sorts of collective action problems. So, like, I think you and I can both recognize, and most reasonable people can recognize, that this inequality is a result of a problematic culture in sport. Now, on an individual level, is it going to be hard for you to address that inequality? It's going to be impossible. But what are you going to do? Are you going to try to do something about it or not? Because if you don't, then it's never going to get better. It's never going to get better. And I think that, you know, a lot of people might view what you said as like an attack, like, hey, I'm a 40-year-old white male swim coach. I think that coaching is going to be better for me if more women are coaching. Like, I believe that 100%. The culture will improve if we clean some of this stuff up. And therefore, it's worth doing the hard stuff to actually foster that environment in the future, even if maybe I don't get to see the real benefits of it in my career lifetime, which is very likely.
Well, I mean, look, you're never going to coach a national team because of your views on a lot of things with United States swimming. They will make sure that you don't. And that's just the reality of it. And, you know, I point to track and field. Bill Squires was the most successful coach, bar none. He coached Salazar, Bill Rogers, Greg Meyer, Dick Beardsley, all kinds of people that you probably know being from Boston. He was extremely successful. And USA Track and Field wouldn't give him the time of day. But yet, runners from all over the world and coaches from all over the world were coming to Boston to see what he was doing. And one of the things that he taught me was the ego of the coach should never be bigger than the ego of the athlete. And I've noticed this in swimming as well as track and field. Look, you know, my track coach used to say, I could coach Michael Phelps. Look at the guy. Like, obviously, with just basic understanding, that kid's going to be a good swimmer. And coaches need to recognize that. And when, one of the things I tell parents is, when you hear a coach saying, I've got the secret formula, okay, run the other direction. Okay, when you see that, that's a massive red flag.
Yeah.
Not just for sexual abuse, but for a lot of other problems that you don't want to be around. And, you know, the most important event in your athletic career was your conception. Okay? I mean, like it or not, John Little was never going to be an Olympic marathoner. You know, I mean, in the United States, maybe for Canada or something I could have been. But the bottom line was, I have some genetic, I saw the guys, I got close enough to see the guys that were going to make it, and then it wasn't me.
Yeah.
And that's just, my parents didn't have enough juice, and that's the problem.
Right. You should have picked better parents, but you didn't.
I should have picked, yes, some parents born at altitude would have been wonderful for me. But,
right,
you know, that's the bottom line. We need to recognize that in athletics. And I think, you know, specific things we could do is a union for athletes. And I have two really scary swimming stories I think are very important here. These are swimmers that you guys know that are your most decorated Olympians. One of them had the same lawyers as the lawyers that were representing United States Swimming. And she had gotten into some issues. And I said to her, I said, hey, you know, you should be sponsored by Mercedes or Toyota or Ford or something. But you can't be because of these agreements that swimming and the USOC have entered into.
Right.
You need a lawyer who's not the lawyers for the people that are keeping you from getting these deals. And it was like, it just didn't register with her. And another time I had a very decorated athlete call me and say, hey, I want to tell you what happened to me, but if I sue about this, I'm going to fail my drug test. And they weaponize USADA and WADA against these high-level athletes. I have no indication that she was on drugs. But they would say it because you know where Travis Tiger was working before he became the head of USADA? At Brian Cave litigating against me on behalf of swimming, trying to keep sexual abuse victims from getting anywhere. And that's the situation we're operating in. The cure for that is a real athletes union. A real athletes union. The athletes at the top need to strike. They need to show up at the Olympic trials in track and swimming and gymnastics and just say, we're not competing. But they won't do that.
I mean, John, I'm smirking, and the people who are you know, not going to see the video, maybe a video clip of this, and just going to listen to the podcast, I'm just smirking in the background because I just had a coach's clinic over the weekend, and I was telling a story. Like So in my work, I do consulting with coaches. I still coach athletes one-to-one, and I was on the pool deck with a coach, and you know, there'd been some discussion earlier, like, hey, don't touch the political third rail, but I am going to touch the political third rail for the purposes of this story, just because I was sharing the pool deck with a guy who I would bet my house he voted Republican in every election, except maybe the last presidential. You know, like, he's one of those guys, right? And we're standing there, and he goes, Chris, you know what the problem in swim coaching is? And I totally agree with him, by the way. He goes, there's always a new guy who's willing to take too little money to do the job. They get in completely over their heads. And when they get in completely over their heads, bad stuff happens, right? They end up, at best, they end up screaming at some kid, ruining the experience for some kid, and then flaming out of the sport. Right. But I think you've probably seen some examples where guys get in over their head and they're sexually abusing kids. They have substance abuse problems, et cetera, et cetera. I do think those two things are related. And he was like, you know, we should get together and we should set some terms for, like, what is a minimum, you know, you can hire a swim coach for. And I just look at him. I go, are you suggesting we start a union? And he goes, no, not a union, not a union. I said, bargain and say...
No, that's
so
what coaches,
I'm with you.
Yeah, and coaches need to do that too. And that kind of – why should the USOC be getting billions of dollars just from NBC, leaving alone all their other sponsorships, and the athletes and the coaches that produce the medals and money get none? That's the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is if you try to have this conversation with a 20-year-old who's now gone from getting nothing to a couple $100,000 a year, but she's really worth a couple $1 million a year – you just can't. It's like crickets. And they pick off the Misty Hymans of the world and the Susan Westners, and they give them jobs,
right?
At, you know, with the NGBs, and they become good little soldiers down the road. And we've got to end that. We've got to get outside voices running these sports. We've got to cap the executive pay. I mean, just think, if you took Max Siegel at track and field, is making $3 million a year, and you said, we're only going to pay you $500,000, which for Indianapolis is boy band money. And we just gave the other $2.5 million in $50,000 grants to every athlete who made, you know, the top eight in the Olympic trials or something. That would totally change the trajectory of those athletes.
Right.
Or, hey, if you're a coach and you've got five athletes in the Olympic trials, here's $50,000.
Here's a bonus. Yeah.
Right. So in 2016... track and field paid Max Siegel a gold medal bonus. I don't remember. It was well into the seven figures. But the gold medal bonus for athletes was $30,000.
I got mad. I mean, one of the things I've talked about on the podcast here earlier, and I did actually, you know, it's funny you say I'll probably never be on a USA Swimming national staff, but I do talk to people at USA Swimming, and I have friendly relationships with people that work at USA Swimming. And I did this podcast because I was reviewing their financials for the year. And, you know, I was talking about some of the criticisms that I have in it. And, like, I got a call from somebody at USA Swimming to say, like, you're dead on with this. I go, the biggest, set aside, right, the fact that I think we both, you can just no comment this if you want, but they lost a lot of money last year because they had to settle a lot of lawsuits that have been ongoing. But they also lose a lot of money every year because they spend so much money on an executive suite that doesn't do jack crap for anybody that participates in the sport of swimming. They don't do anything. They don't they at best are a non-factor. At worst, they're actually making it a lot harder for people to make a living, to sustain stuff in the sport of swimming, to grow their teams, et cetera, et cetera. That's just my contention of it. And I think there's people even within these organizations who, if they took, you know, a kind of a hard look, they go, yeah, it's true.
No, and it's true across the board. And, you know, swimming, they've got a big problem. And I have some theories as to why the raping of children is worse in swimming than a lot of other sports. But as the graft and insider dealing and stuff that is just an epidemic in Olympic sports worldwide, I recommend for anybody, read the book Lords of the Rings, which was written in 1986 by Andrew Jennings. It's horrifying. And that was 1986. That was before Nike was pumping money into all this.
Right, before the Olympics was a big business like it is today. Yeah.
It just they just had a lot of connections with Avery Brundage and Juan Antonio Samaroc and Hitler and Franco, and there's all kinds of great stories in there. But the graft in the other NGBs is probably worse than it is in swimming.
I want to ask you about that later, but I want to focus the story back and get us closer to the present. So you get involved, you're suing USA Swimming, and for everybody, like, what, as far as you can tell, has been USA Swimming's response on an organizational level to these lawsuits? Like, what have they done to change their process?
Well, you know, look, you go from 1986, their solution in 1986 was to offshore their assets and
to Barbados.
To Barbados. Then you move up to, say, 2007, 2008, Max Siegel, who's now the CEO of track and field, but was on the Swimming Foundation board of directors. Jack Swarbrick, who was just recently retired as the athletic director of Notre Dame, was another attorney advising swimming, and Chuck Welges. What they did then was to take money out of swimming and start overfunding these foundations.
USA Swimming Foundation being an example of this.
Correct. And being the biggest example, if you go look at their tax returns from that time. So they move from offshoring their assets to hiding them in, not hiding, but switching them to this foundation. Now, you know, if in 2010 USA Swimming had set aside $10 million and said, look, here's $10 million. We're going to have a fund. We're going to administer it. We're going to pay for everybody's counseling and therapy. And we're sorry about what happened. They would look like PR geniuses, and they'd have saved millions of dollars. They'd have diffused a ton of lawsuits. That's not the path they took, obviously. They fought us tooth and nail. Now, you know, that they've brought the insurance back into the United States, you are getting the outside perspective of American insurance companies that have an interest in resolving this stuff. So I would say swimming's attitude now is, you know, we'll let the insurance companies handle it, which is the attitude of every major corporation when, you know, there's a truck accident or whatever it is. So I wouldn't say there's been much change in swimming. Like, swimming hasn't had a come-to-Jesus moment in the leadership of the organization. They've just started making better economic decisions, I think. So they have done nothing to address the real structural problem, which is the massive power imbalance between the unpaid labor and the executives.
Yeah.
As long as there's new kids coming along, it doesn't really matter to swimming if these kids are raped or not. There's going to be more kids, right? So,
well, what what I wanted to get at with that question too is, I guess I read a long article. You're probably familiar with the journalist. She writes now for Defector.
Diana Moskowitz,
right?
Yeah.
She did a great long form piece on, you know, where we are with the U.S. Center for Safe Sport.
they're right trying now, to ban me.
Which is not in a good place. Okay. Right. Well, like, and you know, for people who have been following this story in swimming, like, you know that really the U.S. Center for Safe Sport has its roots in swimming, right? When you talk about 2008, 2009, we called it athlete protection first before some PR guy went like, ooh, it's not good to call it athlete protection because that implies that kids need protecting from something, right? So, like, let's rebrand it. We'll call it Safe Sport. So USA Swimming had something called Safe Sport originally. Then that was used as a model for developing this U.S. Center for Safe Sport. What is, I mean, people can probably guess what your opinion is, but I think your answer is going to be interesting. What is your opinion on these so-called Safe Sport initiatives?
Okay, well, first of all, the Center for Safe Sport is worse than useless. You have to understand the goal of the Center for Safe Sport is to protect the USOC and the NGBs from civil liability.
Yeah, so they're basically shielding, like they're adding an extra layer,
right,
where they can suss out where there's potential lawsuits coming beforehand, right?
Correct. And so here's what you have to understand. Calling Safe Sport is like calling your local diocese to complain about a priest raping your kid. That is exactly what it is. Okay, so I have seen Safe Sport and USA Swimming when they had the Safe Sport program under Nice Swimming intentionally ruin criminal investigations, high level ones. Like the FBI was coming to an apartment in Seattle, and either Susan or Safe Sport called the suspected coach named Sean Hutchinson and told him it was coming, right? So, and, you know, the FBI shows up, and lo and behold,
he's gone.
What they're looking for is not there. Sean was in Brazil or Italy or wherever he went. And I've seen that multiple times. I've seen the USA Swimming or the Center for Safe Sport give incorrect information to a California police department about the alleged victim's age, making her 18 instead of 17, conveniently. I've seen them on another super high-performing coach in Indiana not turn over their information to the police. Because the internal investigation is corporate America's new way of mitigating. Right? We're going to do an internal investigation. Never trust
we've hired an outside firm to do an internal investigation. Yes.
That stuff is – we have an outside firm. They're called the fucking police. Like, why shouldn't you call the police? That is the literal law, okay?
Right.
I encourage all your listeners. I want to be very clear on this. Even if you're a member of an NGB, if you don't call Safe Sport, you can be kicked out of the NGB, okay? If you don't call the police, you can go to jail, all right? That is the law in 37 states, okay? That's the law. Safe Sport is like they made this rule. They can take away your coaching certificate. But they can't. You can't be sued civilly for not reporting to Safe Sport, and you can't go to prison for not reporting to Safe Sport. But if you do not report a reasonable suspicion of child abuse, that's the language in Indiana, you can go to prison. Okay?
Yeah.
You have to call the police. I don't know how to make it more clear. And you don't do anything else until the police tell you it's okay to call Safe Sport. Call the police and do what they say. Okay? Do not interact with Safe Sport until after law enforcement has told you you can. I don't know how else to make it more clear. And so Safe Sport is trying to ban me. I still have active role with coaching and such. I'm not a member of any national governing body. But from September 2021 until January of this year, I was under investigation, in quotes, by Safe Sport for telling people to call the police.
Well, listen, like you're getting to something that I want to ask about, because I was at this, as I said, I was at this gathering of coaches, and just listening to, like, I went out to dinner with a group and we started talking about this stuff because, you know, I've been prominently out there on this topic in the sport of swimming. So people end up talking to me about it. And like, you know, I was down in Texas. So actually I was reminiscing about that the last time that I had been down in Texas, and people can get into my blog archives if you want to catch up on this story, but was right around when I started writing about Scott McFarland, and we actually succeeded in getting Scott McFarland off deck with his team down in Texas, but it created a real awkward situation for me because the guy who had invited me, like the coach who was in charge of inviting me onto this trip, was a guy who worked with Scott McFarland. And as far as I could tell, did not want to believe, right, that Scott McFarland had raped kids, right?
Right.
And I guess where I'm going with this in talking with a lot of these coaches is you say Safe Sport is worse than ineffective. And I would agree with you because what I'm observing is that it's been weaponized, right?
It is, absolutely.
It's been weaponized, so it's both ineffective in preventing abuse and sexual abuse, but it is effective at being wielded like vindictively in certain situations to
100% true.
Get rid of somebody you don't want, right?
I would say, case in point, Terry McKeever. But going on, what?
Well, we'll agree to disagree about Terry McKeever. But I've
seen behind the curtain, and the allegations made are not supported by the evidence. And I was her lawyer, but I would not have risked my career defending somebody if I thought that they had done even a tenth of what they said Terry McKeever did. But here's the point about safe sport being weaponized. Yes, it is absolutely weaponized. You know, Megan Reither and I have not gotten along since we were 18 years old. Yet she allowed, when she was board, she was on the board of Safe Sport until December of 22. She pursued me to try to ban me from sport and keep me from representing. I wasn't allowed to represent anybody in safe sport proceedings while this proceeding against me was going on, right? So they do use it. I call it a quasi-federal agency run by children, right? You have all these petty, small, bureaucratic, incompetent clowns that the Olympic movement breeds, and they put them at safe sport as a stepping stone to the USOC maybe or wherever they're going to go, and they use it to settle political scores. And look, Terry McKeever is a great example. She was accused of yelling at kids, saying things, doing things that some of them she did and she shouldn't have, okay? But she was selectively pursued.
I agree with that. I have the very nuanced opinion that both, I mean, I believe that Terry stepped on pool deck and chronically told kids they were pieces of shit. And I don't think you should coach if you're doing that, right? Do I think that you could log similar charges against most of the head coaches in Division I athletics, swimming? Absolutely. And Terry was chosen. You're mm-hmm. absolutely right. In my opinion, she was targeted.
And the reason why Terry was targeted is, in one particular high-profile case, Terry McKeever was on the USA Swimming Board of Directors, and she is the only person I know in all of swimming who had a stake in it who said, look, no, what I saw at this meet in Victoria, this is what I saw, and that wasn't what swimming needed her to say. Right. And that's why they got mad at her, specifically. But you're right. I agree with you. She was selectively prosecuted by Safe Sport. But what we need to do, this goes back to the cultural change. And this is something I've noticed about swimming that I think puts the kids in a uniquely vulnerable
spot. Yeah, please. This was
going
to be my next question. So get there anyway, because this is – we coaches and parents listen to this. So this is like – this is important advice for them.
And I don't think there's any more rapey coaches in swimming than there are in track, okay? Like, what I think the difference is in swimming, there's two problems. One, you're inside and you're isolated. You're off to the side of the school. You know, you're in a separate building, and there's really nobody else around to watch, right? Versus track, the kids right. are outside. Anybody can walk their dog by the track and see. Okay, I don't know if we can actually fix that, right? It's just the realities of a pool. But another thing that swim athletes and their relationship with coaches – there's much more loyalty in swimming to the coaches than there is in any other sport I've seen. And I don't know where that comes from. And there's obviously some very good things that can come from that. I think that having a relationship with your coach who knows you for years and years and years can individualize training. And there's no greater crime in athletics than not individualizing training. But at the same time, where track athletes switch coaches all the time, like, it's not uncommon, multiple times a year. That's not happening in swimming.
Yeah.
And that leads to these situations. And I think the cultural changes we talked about earlier with the young males seeing their male coaches dating the females that are their age, those things could be mitigated. This whole cultural change, you wouldn't have the Terry McKeevers yelling at you on pool deck if you were just like, you know what, I'm going to go cross town. That would make a massive difference. And so I don't know how, like, I'm just starting to get into this now with this club I'm dealing with in Massachusetts called Brunel's Gators. They're now called Bay State Gators, but it's exactly the same operation with exactly the same people. They talk about 47 years of tradition, you know, in 2015 when they changed the name and everything else.
Kind of like, by the way, I'll say, kind of like how Curl Burke Swim Club just one day decided they'd be nation's capital aquatic club. Nobody, I'm always the turd in the punch bowl in the swimming world pointing this out, right? You know, but because they're one of the top clubs in America. But like they just woke up one day and be like, oh yeah, Rick Curl? Who is that? But we've had a great club here for all this time and, you know, continue to celebrate. We're not going to change anything else but the name, but like, don't worry, we got it now.
Right, and that kind of loyalty doesn't exist in other sports, and I think there's positives and negatives of that that are unique to swimming that I haven't seen. I mean, I've sued taekwondo, tennis, fencing, track, gymnastics, obviously. I can't remember all the sports I've sued, but this kind of unique club and coach loyalty in swimming is a problem and a benefit. And I think that swimming needs to deal with that somehow.
Yeah, well, this is what part of what I was, and I want to get to this Bernal's case before we finish this, but part of what I was saying to coaches, because there's also a lot of coaches in the room, and they were saying, you know, like stuff's changed and, you know, the respect, like the sort of default level of respect kids have for us has changed and the sort of like willingness to just, automatically do what we're setting out for them. And I go, yeah, but you know what we all have to realize is that when more of that existed, there were a lot more kids that got abused, right? Mm-hmm. Like that. And we had people at the highest levels of our sport who completely abused that trust that families and kids put in them. And now we're dealing with the legacy of that. Maybe our most powerful people are putting, you know, cotton swabs in each of their ear and just going la 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 la. But like on the ground as coaches, we actually have to deal with the legacy of that. And part of that will be people don't trust us. People don't have that natural trust for authority figures. And we have to be able to say, and part of where I was getting to the point of it is we have to be able to say as coaches, like, it's all right to be hard on people. It's all right to be demanding on them. It's all right to train people really hard. And then that doesn't mean that you can do all this abusive stuff. Those two aren't the same thing. They're not. We need them separated from each other. And they've been intertwined with each other, I think, for a long time in the sport of swimming. And I noticed it because I coached abroad. And I don't want to say Denmark's some paradise where no kids get sexually abused. But I do think that there's a way lower incidence of it over there. And one of the things I noticed coaching over there was there wasn't that power distance, right? A 10-year-old would come up and look at my practice on the board and go, by the way, they all swear, all the little kids. So you'd go, that's a stupid fucking practice. And I'd be like, what? Excuse me? You know, but he wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid to give his opinion to, you know, the head coach of the team. And he wasn't afraid that I was going to, he didn't think I had any power to do anything bad to him. And I think that speaks to a different like hierarchy and a different relationship that people have within the sport. So it is deeply cultural.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. I think, you know, I think the biggest thing we can do to protect kids in our sport is number one, provide training to all the kids. Make the safe sport training mandatory to the kids. And I got problems with safe sport training, but it's better than nothing. These situations, parents will ask me, you know, what's a child molester? Like, who's a child molester? Look, I've seen really good-looking guys molest kids. I've seen educated guys molest kids. And I've seen the people you would suspect, like Brian Hinson. If you looked at him, you would say, oh, that guy's a creep. I've seen that, too. And the thing we can do to protect our kids is give them the language, say vulva, say penis, so you know what they're talking about. Teach them anatomy. But the thing that's the biggest thing is if we teach all their teammates what's going on, never ride home with coaches alone, never be alone with a coach. Most of my cases get blown up when a teammate of the victim says something to their parents or a teacher or something like that. That's how it usually ends. Molesters, right. There's no typical molester, but there are typical victims. And the typical victim is somebody who comes from a conservative home where you're never going to discuss sex and they don't have the language to discuss their own body, or there's no one to go home and talk to. And then number three, typically my victims are the better athletes.
Yeah.
And so with those three things in mind, if coaches would gear their interactions towards kids with those three things in mind, we could do a lot to protect kids and demystify, you know, it's going back to what my coach said, you know, take the egos out of it, realize that, you know, you're talented swimmers. You may be a good coach, but they're talented because of the genetics. Okay. and you're guiding them, but you didn't make this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I those echo, you made me feel good because those echo what I do in my house. I mean, I have a 10-year-old and I have a 5-year-old. We use all the anatomically, right. Correct. Terms for private parts. And one of the things I told, I tell them from the first day they go to school, I go, no adult should ever ask you to keep a secret from me.
Yep.
Ever. Like, 100%. There should be no adult that ever needs you to keep a secret from me. Right. And I think just basic stuff like that does go a long way. And I bring that to my coaching practice. I go, there should never be anything. My standard for how I behave on the pool deck is, like, the last place I coached, it was literally impossible for parents to watch me coach. But I coach as if they're watching, as if they were standing right next to me, so that I know, you know, like, if I have to talk to some parent at some other time and they say, you know, well, we've been hearing this stuff at practice, I'm not ashamed of anything that happened at practice. I know what happened there. And I know it was above board, and I know that any reasonable person watching it, you know, like, there's nothing to keep a secret, right? And then you get into the space of, like, oh, parents wouldn't understand, you know, what I'm doing. I think as a coach, you're treading on thin ice, right?
Well, when you say parents wouldn't understand what you're doing, I think that points to your deficiencies as a coach, or you're covering something nefarious. Because I think, in my opinion, one of the best things a coach can do is make an athlete understand their body, make the athlete understand what's going on, why you're doing what you're doing, why you're periodizing your training the way you are, and empower that athlete to be able to coach themselves, to make the decision, hey, I need to take 2 days off. And one of the things that I notice when I coach is that my really dedicated athletes, I've got to, like,
I have to force them to not come
to practice, right? Like, if I tell, like, they need to have the mental empowerment to say, you know, I'm not feeling that good, because I've expound the opposite, right? Like, they'll push themselves through anything. And so I think teaching your athletes to understand, your parents to understand, is part of coaching. So that's your problem, that's your shortcoming, or you're hiding something. And that's what I see. You know, a lot of my clients say, I really didn't want to lose swimming. And we should be saying as coaches, it's your genetic gift. You don't have to put up with this. Go swim across the street.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say what I try to impress upon other coaches is this stuff is an existential threat to the sport of swimming. If people don't trust, like, if that trust continues, mistrust continues to grow between parents and the sport of swimming, there won't be a sport of swimming. Or there won't be a sport of swimming for most of us to work in. It'll just become more and more niche. And that is something that's happened. I want to get to the case that you're working on now. And I'll say this as part of a way of introducing it, because this is near and dear to my heart. I mean, I grew up in Massachusetts, which is a backwater in many ways of American swimming. And, you know, I first got put on my senior team of my club growing up when I was 13 years old, actually. And as part of that, we would practice every summer at Hanscom Air Force Base, because there's not a lot of long course, you know, Olympic size 50 meter pools in the area, from 5 to 8 in the morning. And we split this pool at Hanscom Air Force Base with Bernal's Gators Swim Club. And that was my first introduction to Bernal. And it's one of those things, you say you're 14, you're 18, you're 40. I was 14. I remember knowing at that moment, on some level, that Joe Bernal was sexually abusing kids. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew, like, because I ended up leaving the team that I was on, and I remember there was never any conversation in my house, let's go swim for Gators. Like, because that guy's a sex abuser and we're not going to join his team. Like, that was just, it was a non-starter. Tell people about how you got on the track of Joe Bernal and what you're working on now.
Sure. So, unfortunately, you know, it's like my other swimming cases. There's a victim from the early 70s when he was in New York City. And I
then
have
his
another
Fordham days, like pre-Bernal Gators even.
Well, no, they were Bernal's Gators, but they were in New York.
In
New York. Pre-Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
He moved them to Massachusetts when he went to Harvard.
Okay.
You know, we have uncovered that there were fondling rumors floating around the AAU and USA Swimming since before there was USA Swimming. And sadly, as we've litigated this case, we have now uncovered basically a continuous string of kids that Joe Bernal raped from the early 70s straight through to post-2010. So basically what you have is you have a very, very successful swim coach who was having sex with children continuously from some point in the early 70s through 2015.
Yeah.
And it's alarming. The evidence that we've read, including from his own daughter, shows that everybody was aware of this. They heard fondling rumors. They wrote it off to him being Latin, which I'll get to that in a second.
Yes, this is a big development in the Joe Bernal story. Yeah.
I didn't know any of this when I jumped into it. They wrote it off to him being Latin and a variety of other things. And, you know, there were explicit cries for help to Ann Frazier, Joe Frazier, Alex Cronin, and probably people in the 80s and 90s, but I don't know that. But I do know that by the mid-2000s.
And the Fraziers and Cronin, these are the people that continued to run Bernal's Gators and then Gator Swim Club, which is basically Bernal's. Just explain people maybe that piece of
the
it.
The three board members of Bernal's Gators were Ann Frazier, Joe Frazier, and Joe Bernal. Joe Bernal owned a large percentage of the club, and Joe Frazier owned the remainder. When, in 2015, Bentley University is where this ends, Bentley University got wind that Joe Bernal was sleeping with or had slept with a child in the recent past. Bentley University came to Ann Frazier, Joe Frazier, and Joe Bernal in August or September of 2015 and said, you're not allowed to use our facilities if this guy stays here. In response to that, which we didn't know any of this at the time, Joe Bernal, his real name is Hugo Calderon. And he fled the United States and went back to Colombia, where he is originally from. He was born in Colombia, grew up as a child for some time in Colombia. Skips out of Massachusetts. There's actually a Boston Globe article from late 2015, 2016. Where's Joe Bernal, right? Well, we've now found out he was in Colombia. He sold his house. He sold his swim club, which Joe Frazier referred to as a cash cow, for a very, you know, $400,000+, which was a great price, to Ann Frazier, Joe Frazier, and Alex Cronin. They changed the name to Bay State Gators. They retained the same head coach, Chris Morgan. They retained in their email 47 years of tradition and just kept operating as if Joe Bernal, you know, was still – they wanted the tradition of Bernal, but they didn't want the liability.
We'll just delete
about
the Bernal part. We'll just – but everything else stays.
Everything else stays, and we'll pretend like we don't know about all the kids he's raped over the years. Well, they knew, and USA Swimming got Bernal banned, but Bernal was gone, right? As far as anybody knew, he was gone. Well, it turns out he had gone down to Colombia and resumed his life as Hugo Calderon in Colombia. At some point in I'm not exactly sure when, he makes it back to Miami and passes away in October of 2022. And he had taken the proceeds of his home sale, the proceeds of the sale of the club, through his son, who was an opioid addict, invested in gold bars, body armor, weaponry, stashed that somewhere in Trinidad. Maybe him and John Warrior Trites are running around Trinidad. I don't know. But he stashed his assets in Trinidad and Colombia, and, you know, eventually dies in Miami. So it's a sad story, but through this case from the early 70s, we've learned now of basically a continuous string of children that Burnell raped all the way through until he was finally banned in 2015. And, you know, it's interesting, David Berkoff, who is a – well, you guys know he's an Olympic swimmer and gold medalist, an attorney. Probably
former USA Swimming board member as well.
Right. And I think a good human being. There's board minutes of David Berkoff as a as basically a 20-year-old or a 22-year-old in the early 90s very plainly saying that raping kids is a massive problem in our sport.
Right, right.
And it goes back to my earlier comments about myself as a runner. Look what was happening at the club where Dave Berkoff was a member, right? And here you have the biggest
right,
champion.
Right, because he swam – sorry, just to, yeah. You missed one key detail. He swam for Joe Burnell. At
yeah,
Harvard.
He swam for Joe Burnell. Bobby Hackett at Fordham was a contemporary of one of my current clients, right?
Right.
And I have no reason to think
And Bobby
that
Hackett swam it for Joe Burnell at Harvard.
Right.
Yes.
And I have no reason to think Bobby Hackett is involved in anything nefarious. And in fact, with David Berkoff, I would say he has been nothing but an unwavering proponent of protecting children and swimming since he was literally a teenager. And I give him a lot of credit. But this was happening, like you said, you know, right under your nose. It was happening under my nose. It was happening under David Berkoff's nose.
Yeah.
And, you know, David Berkoff has said under oath he didn't know anything about it, and I believe him.
Mm.
And it's you know, it's very interesting that this can happen and you don't know. While at the same time, I know that Alex Cronin knew that there were allegations of Burnell fondling children all over Massachusetts by the time Alex Cronin is coaching in the mid-2000s, right? So it's very interesting, you know, how these guys operate. Burnell knew to keep anything away from David Berkoff, who's out saying, we got to protect my peers. He was smart enough to do that, right? So these guys are very calculating. They're very good. But USA Swimming will do anything, and any NGB will do anything to protect coaches who produce medals and money. Because at the end of the day, coming full circle, medals and money get you those big contracts with Toyota and NBC and everything else that your unpaid labor doesn't get any benefit from. And as a guy like Joe Burnell is very valuable. There's always more kids. There's always a David Berkoff coming after a Bobby Hackett. But
right.
There's not a lot of Joe Burnells who can win, right, and who can produce medals and money. And that is the bottom line problem in Olympic sport. And that is not unique to swimming.
Yeah.
That's everywhere.
Yeah. I guess I take the perspective on it, though, and I think this is why I think it's really important, the work that you're doing. Because in this case, for instance, you're Joe Burnell being dead. Obviously, you're not suing Joe Burnell, right?
Well, I am. He was alive when we filed the suit.
Okay.
So we've got a claim against his estate. But it's in Colombia or Trinidad
estate.
Or wherever.
Yeah. 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 But you have, like, and I poked at Nation's Capital Aquatic Club, but, like, you could scale this all the way up to USA Swimming. I think you have this stuff come up, and what's fair should be from the start that if you make these kind of catastrophic mistakes, you should have to rip that Band-Aid off and feel the pain of making that kind of mistake. And it sucks in the short term, but in the long term, we build a better sport culture. And what a lot of these organizations have been able to do is just kind of punt on it. They distance themselves from the one person. Oh, we just had this one bad apple. He was a bad guy. Everybody else here is good. Everybody else who, as you said, possibly had knowledge, co-signed on this, sat there complacently and didn't do anything, well, they can just continue on. To me, that's how we end up in the same position over and over and over again, because there's no acknowledgement. Like, I think someplace like Nation's Capital, for instance, they should be out front in terms of U.S. swim clubs being like, we had this guy in our organization and we never want that to happen again, and here is what we're doing. They should acknowledge it, but they won't, because they'll think like, well, we don't want to advertise to parents in the area, new unsuspecting parents, that we had a child rapist running our team for 30 years.
A long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Until he skipped off to Australia, right? And then he came back. And
right. I mean, I get it that they don't want to do that, but like, you know what would be great for the sport of swimming is if they went the other direction, acknowledged what their history is, and actually tried to make a difference in building a different culture for the future. And as far as I can tell, you're the only one that's pushing people to do it.
Well, and I've got a really, and I do appreciate that, because, you know, Brooke, my girlfriend in college, worked so hard. She worked way harder than I did, right?
Yeah.
And I remember that. Like, I got a lot more serious after I started dating her and got better, and I saw that. And I have nothing but good things to say about my coaches. But her, she put so much into this. And look at what she takes out of this. Her memories are there's naked pictures of me all over the internet, right? That's, yeah. If you Google Brooke Taflinger, that's the legacy that she unfortunately has in her sport. And she doesn't deserve that. And all these kids I've helped over the years don't deserve that at all. And it really angers me that coaches would do this to kids. But I think, to really put a horrible example on this as we finish, as the worst thing example I have, Joe Burnell, I could repeat, you could say Joe Burnell or Rick Curl or Andy King or, you know, any of these guys, right?
Infamous.
Right, yeah. So as it will never change until athletes control their own destiny and have a union and have the financial ability to protect themselves. And we haven't really made much progress over the last 17 years I've been doing this. There's a lot of things we talked about today that we could do, but at the end of the day, until I told Richard Young, who was the longtime Don of Olympic sports and the attorney for USA Swimming, I told him, I said, Rich, how's your health? He said, oh, you know, I'm old. I said, well, I want you to stay alive until the athletes can organize in a union. Now he's in his 80s, so we got to hurry up so he can see it. But it's not looking good. Nothing's changed. Usain Bolt even tried to start a union, and there was one prominent swimmer who tried to help him. But I got to say, we worked hard, me and Usain Bolt and this swimmer and a couple other track athletes, and we could not get any traction in swimming and barely any in track.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Do you have 2 more minutes or do you
I got all, I got okay. Another 20 minutes.
Because that's a great conclusion, but I actually want to ask you related to that, because you've been talking about this athlete representation. I wonder if you could comment on, because I hear from a lot of coaches who look at like the ongoing legislation between athletes and the NCAA. Mm-hmm. And I think, if I could sum up a lot of the coaches' opinions on it, they go, well, this is just going to destroy the sport of swimming. Like, athletes getting paid by the NCAA, which I none of them will contend that that's a fair situation. The way that the NCAA is set up right now, that it's fair, right? Mm-hmm. That it's right that, you know, these schools and, for instance, like, you know, Nick Saban is making $10 million, but like the guys on University of Alabama are just barely scratching, you know, some of that stuff, right? None of them contend that that is fair, but they look at it and they go, this is just going to destroy the sport of swimming. You know, like if athletic departments end up having to pay out some of this money, I wonder, do you look at that? Are you optimistic when you see those kind of efforts? Because I'm optimistic when I see them, but I feel like I'm on an island.
I would probably, okay. I think it's going to decouple track and swimming and wrestling from universities. I talked to one coach at a Big Ten school, and he told me he had to raise $500,000 of NIL money, not for his Olympic sport, but it was all, every Olympic sport coach had to raise that to pay football players, right? And, you know, that kind of disparity has always existed, but now it's just massively blown up. You know, no one's coming to the swim team or the cross-country team, especially the men's programs, with any NIL interest, hardly at all, right? I have seen some NIL contracts with high-level women's Olympic sports programs, but as far as the men's sports, you know, the men's Olympic sports are dying a slow death at universities. And I think this is going to exasperate it, and I think that we are very close to the end of college sports besides maybe baseball, soccer, men's and women's basketball, and football. Like, I think they'll thrive.
Okay.
I think the rest of Olympic sport are either going to have to be totally divorced from this madness at the university level, which they'll just be dead weight, which is kind of what they are now in terms financially. But I see it also as an opportunity too, because I think that it's going to, if the NCAA decouples basketball and football, we could have a more just Olympic sport model where like sport is truly part of the university. So that's one opportunity I see. I also see possibly a European style club system could develop, which I think is really the way to go. I'm very involved in the track club in my town. And I see, you know, we've got 80-year-olds who are high-level runners back in the day interacting with 10-year-olds, and we're all paying dues, and it's offering a lot. So I do see that opportunity there. But I don't think at the end of the day the NIL situation is going to be good for Olympic sports. I think women's basketball has shown they can compete and raise their own money. Yeah. Beyond that, every woman's sport is dead weight, and then – maybe soccer and baseball will make it, maybe.
Right.
But it's just going to be men's and women's basketball and football, really, at the end of the day, in the big conferences. I don't think it'll have any effect at Bentley or University of Indianapolis or anything like that.
Right, but Division I power conference swimming, as we know it, could very soon just be a thing of the past, and we might want to start planning to. Well, I think it's a very important question to ask at the swimming level, because right now, like, you talk about the failures of USA Swimming. I mean, they're really relying on that high-end university system to provide, like, these little regional training centers for Olympic-caliber swimmers.
Right, so, oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, we'd have to do something else. We would have to have something in place to replace that.
Right, which you very well could. And see, that's the problem. Right now, the system is great for NGBs. The colleges and the high school levels develop all the talent.
Yeah.
They go to USA Swimming, which doesn't have to pay for the development or the hours served for USA Swimming, and gets all the money.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
So I mean, you cannot fuck up running an NGB. I mean, if your goal is to be rich, go to an NGB and become the president. You're going to get rich and not have to do anything. That model is dying. And I think that regional training centers would be one way to go, a very likely way to go. But that would require the Tim Hinchies of the world to give up some of their own spoils, which history has shown they're very reluctant to do.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, why, you know, my personal opinion is, why do we even need NGBs across the board? Why do we need them? The USOC is already bloated with a whole bunch of people that don't do anything, right? Like, let's let them run the logistics of high-level sport and develop something else much more localized. You know, it's like every problem we have in America. Community is falling apart. We need to bring this stuff back in our communities, sport too, and we can do more and target it better at the community level. There's no reason to have national governing bodies. There's no reason to have safe sport. And the USOC should just be a travel agency coordinating the logistics of getting people to Pan Ams, World Champs, and the Olympics. I mean, that's really how it should be.
Organize a national championship and Olympic trials, but, like, you know.
Right. But then where else would Max Siegel and Tim Hinchie make their money, right?
Yeah.
They'd have to get a job doing something good.
You might have to go do a job of comparable size, which is like be a D3 athletic director, but that only makes, you know, $200,000 a year, not $1 million. So,
yeah, it's sad.
Yeah,
but there wouldn't be anybody anywhere for the Wasserman family to place their less qualified
scions.
Like Sarah Hirschlin. Yeah, they're clowns. I mean, they're complete clowns. But this has been well known about the Olympic movement since forever. And the real suckers in this are cities like Los Angeles and Indianapolis and Colorado Springs that dump bazillions of dollars into letting these organizations suck off them. And it's pathetic. You know, the NFL and all the, you know, sport does that all the way around. And we've got to get sport in the proper place. And really, one of the reasons I've seen for molestation, I've had a lot of parents tell me, oh, we knew he molested Susie or Sally 10 years ago, but he's a really good coach, or we really needed a scholarship, or we really wanted her to be an Olympian. right? And so we've got to bring sport back to its proper place and make it community focused. And so, unfortunately, this NIL situation, in my opinion, is probably going to make that happen like in 5 years without any plans made.
Right.
I just don't see it. Indiana University track and field, I don't know. I just don't see it sticking around. Times the whole Big Ten.
Okay. Well, a sobering podcast with John Little, but obviously we went long, but I could do this with you for hours. We always have a good time talking with each other, and I think probably a lot on here that's going to piss off at least one piece will piss off somebody that listens to it, but I think if you're fired up about this stuff, get in the conversation and get involved, because I think more than anything, a lot of people that I talk to just seem to be complacent on this. Mm-hmm. And there's no room for complacency, because it is existential stuff we're talking about. If you love your sport, then you got to have a stance on this. And you got to have an idea of sort of where we're headed. It's a pleasure. Good luck, John.
Thanks, Chris.
And everything that
you're
doing.
Good luck to you, man.
Yeah, thank you. Good luck to you. I appreciate it. And for everybody listening, if you want to reach out and get in contact with me, swimbriefpodcast@gmail.com or Christy Coach, Christy _coach on Instagram. You can go to christycoach.com. That's my website. And thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you again soon.